The truth is that we are in a climate emergency. We have less than 10 years to make substantial changes to our society and way of life and our economy.
I want to stress from the outset that this pandemic is far from over.
Those who have never fought for the colours they fly should be careful about criticising those who have.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Caroline Hepke. Boris Johnson has told Bloomberg that COP26, the global climate talks the UK is hosting at the end of the month in Glasgow, will be extremely tough. This as the government has unveiled a £3.9 billion plan to drive down carbon emissions from homes and offices, including grants worth £5,000 to help householders replace gas boilers with heat pumps. Now, the Prime Minister has been speaking exclusively to Bloomberg's editor-in-chief, John Micklethwaite, in a wide-ranging interview touching on the energy transition, but also investment from China, the Northern Ireland Protocol, and the future of the City of London. In a moment, I'm going to speak to John about his interview, along with Bloomberg's managing editor for News, David Merritt. But first, let's hear what the Prime Minister had to say to Bloomberg, starting with taxes and regulation.
We've been through a colossal pandemic, which has necessitated the, sadly necessitated the expansion of state activity into all sorts of fields that neither you nor I would have wanted or would previously have contemplated.
I mean, yes, you're putting up corporate taxes, say, from 19% to 25%.
They'll remain amongst the lowest in the G7 and
but will you reduce them ever?
And you can certainly take. I don't want to anticipate any decisions that the Chancellor may make on the fiscal side, but you can take it that Rishi Sunak is, and as indeed am I, is a staunch low tax conservative, and he believes in an enterprise economy, and that's why we're doing all the things that we're doing. And one of the things that we're doing to make this country more attractive to invest in is, Rishi brought in a big, you talk about tax, huge super deduction for companies to invest in capital and plant, and write that off against tax in order to deal with that productivity issue that we face. The UK is an incredibly successful economy, given that, you know, we basically don't exploit the potential of so much of it. That's what the whole levelling up agenda is all about.
Can we talk about what many people would see as the most successful part of the British economy? You have the global captains of, you know, BlackRock, yes, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan. They're all coming to this conference, and they would all say the same thing, that yes, they like the City of London, but they're also hedging their bets. They're putting some jobs in Paris and Amsterdam.
But behind all of it,
they would say, look, we are an industry. Finance and insurance is an industry that brings in £160 billion a year to the British economy. Fishing brings in less than £1 billion. And you put most of your energy arguing with the French about fishing rather than this big issue of finance.
No, on the contrary, in 2008, 2009, there was literally only one politician who spoke up repeatedly for the City of London, for bankers, and that was me. And I know that the City of London is crucial, not just for our country, but for the whole of Europe and for this hemisphere. And that's why, if not the world, and that's why I think that it's profoundly in the interests of our partners to ensure that we do have good relations. We do continue to see proper flow of capital and services between London and all the other parts of Europe. And I'm sure that will continue. If you want to raise money around Europe, if you want to finance your merger or whatever it is, London is still the place to come, and always will be. But I think the interesting thing about the way finance is going is that so much of it now is in fintech and it's the tech side that is developing so fast. And there, you've got to admit, John, you know, the UK has an extraordinary kind of mixture of things that make it propitious for that kind of development. And, I think I'm right in saying now that we've got 106 or more tech unicorns, unicorn for the benefit of both the Bloomberg viewers who don't yet know, or any Bloomberg viewer who doesn't yet know, a unicorn being not a mythical beast, but a company.
A company with $1 billion in revenues.
Billions of dollars in revenues, thank you. There are 106 in this country. Another European Union nation that I will, you know, modesty forbids me from mentioning, has a quarter of that number.
I think that's France, but just to use that point, I mean, that is exactly what the hard-headed captains of industry will say. They will say, look, you are stuck in these arguments with France about fishing, about finance. No, but they are the people, as you well know, who are blocking the City of London's ability to be able to trade with the rest of Europe or to get a deal on that. I mean, is it time to sort of fix those squabbles?
I think there's, I've got great relations with the French government, with Emmanuel Macron, and will continue to ensure that the UK and France have a very close contact, sharing the private conversation. But the UK and France have been, you know, mass serré, or whatever the phrase, for a long, long time. And if you look at what we do together around the world, we're very close partners, we're friends, and it's vital. And it is the deep will of our populations that should remain the case, and we will continue to do great things together. Is there a problem with the Northern Irish Protocol? Yes, there is, but we'll fix that, and I don't think that's going to be the end of the world.
Can I ask you about another big country? You look around the world, the biggest source of investment at the moment, the biggest source of FDI is China. $130 billion they're investing overseas at the moment. You look at, you've come up with this strategy saying that you will let them invest in non-strategic assets, which seems to be not Huawei, not technology, and not nuclear power. And I wondered what sort of things will they be allowed to invest in? You talked about infrastructure. They're the biggest infrastructure.
Si monumentum requiris circumspici.
When I was running
London, I went out several times to China and had fantastic trips there.
Investment in
stuff that drives jobs and growth in this country, whether it's in development, look at what's happening in Greenwich, Vauxhall Nine Elms, things have taken off there because of Chinese investment. So I'm not going to tell you, John, that the UK government is going to pitchfork away every overture from China. Of course not. China is a gigantic part of our economic life and will be for a long time, for our lifetimes. But that does not mean that we should be naive in the way that we look at our critical national infrastructure, the way we look at, you mentioned nuclear power, you mentioned 5G technology. Those are all legitimate concerns that any government, many, many other governments around the world have. But I've said this many times, it's worth repeating, I am no Sinophobe, very far from it.
Do you think you're the last Sinophile in the cabinet?
No, I expect there are lots of... China is a great country and civilisation.
What about wind power? Would you let them buy offshore wind power?
You'd have to look at what was your defining as strategic or critical. But I certainly think that having our trading relationship with China, if you look at it, it's in spite of all the difficulties, in spite of all the sort of angry conversations about or the difficult conversations about the Dalai Lama or Hong Kong or the Uyghurs, and where we will continue to stick to our points, right? We will continue to stick to our views. But actually, trade with China has continued to expand for a very long time, and I think probably will continue to expand, as I say, for the rest of our lives. That doesn't mean that we should be, we should be cautious about how we handle our CNI and about how we handle FDI from China into some of our sensitive industries. And that's why we brought in some of the legislation that we have.
We were talking about China.
Yes.
Obviously a huge deal in COP. And Xi Jinping looks unlikely to come at the moment. What do you think is a realistic goal? What's your personal goal in terms of COP?
Look, I think COP was always going to be extremely tough. We're hoping that we'll get a good turnout in spite of the pandemic. What we want people to focus on is their nationally determined contributions in reducing their CO2, making those hard pledges. Plus, we want commitments on coal, cars, cash and trees. So we want the world to move away from coal by 2040, 2030 for the developed nations. We want to make sure that everybody stops using hydrocarbon-fueled internal combustion engine cars. And the UK is in the lead there. We said that we would stop that by 2030. We want a big package for the developing world to help countries that haven't been historic emitters to cut their carbon. So we need that $100 billion a year. We need that $100 billion. The last thing is we want to make sure that we plant millions and millions of trees to help to fix the carbon and to restore the balance of nature. So we need the nationally determined contribution. We need to keep 1.5 alive. We need to restrict the growth in temperatures to 1.5 degrees by the end of the century. We think that with the commitments that we're seeing, we could do it, but we're going to need to see some real action from the participants in Glasgow.
Now, we've just heard from Bloomberg's exclusive interview with the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. And joining me now in the London radio studio is Bloomberg's Editor-in-Chief, John Micklethwaite, and Bloomberg's UK National Editor, David Merritt. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for being with me. So as the weather turns autumnal here in London this week, it's perhaps too easy to imagine a very difficult winter ahead. High COVID cases, rising energy prices, labour shortages, and this ongoing Brexit tussle. But today, the Prime Minister made the case for investing in Britain and its green revolution at the first Global Investor Summit, which attracted many Wall Street top executives to London. He sounded ever the optimistic champion of these British Isles. And before that speech, of course, which I watched live on YouTube, full of jokes, he sat down with our own editor-in-chief to answer some, well, reasonably tough questions, John. So let's start there. Boris Johnson, he doesn't often give these long sit-down interviews to answer some questions on domestic issues. Quite tough to be a low-tax Tory in a country where taxes are about to go up.
Yes, and it's true. It wasn't actually that long. It's only about 14 minutes. So even then, I don't think we can claim it's sort of massively in-depth. But yes, I think that's almost the fundamental deal with Boris. I mean, Boris used to be a kind of liberal conservative in the sense of an old style liberal. Mm-hmm. And we were doing the interview in Margaret Thatcher's study, and they had Hayek's Road to Serfdom in the bookshelves, and that used to be his sort of creed. He made his name as a journalist in Brussels, attacking the evil bureaucrats of and making fun of them a lot of Brussels and objecting to it. And the interesting thing is the Tory party he's building now is much more a kind of big government one. And it's a big government one, much more preoccupied with things outside London, much less prepared to let sort of free enterprise rip. And that has many political points, but actually economically, it's harder to justify. Why, a bit like I put to him in the interview, why is he spending so much time worrying about fishing, which I think is worth about $800 million a year to the British economy, and not really very much worrying about finance and insurance, which is $160 billion. And by any measure, he spent 10 times as much time on the fishing.
And yet, of course, in what has been an incredibly tumultuous time in the UK, just a few weeks ago, the Prime Minister was at the Tory party conference, and his own MPs, the Tory faithful, you love the message from Boris Johnson, effectively, and yet there are so many difficulties. I mean,
love it because he's winning. The interesting thing about the Tory party conference was the level, even though around, as you point out absolutely rightly, there was truckers not turning up, there was no fuel, there were all these things. The Tories still sense, or at least the message I got very clearly, they still think that this is their country at the moment. Mm. They are ahead. They don't see Starmer as a particularly serious problem. They're possibly a bit more frightened by Andy Burnham if he appeared. But they think that Boris has got control of the narrative And at the moment, I think, to be fair, it feels like that.
Yes, and if you count the newspaper headlines over the last 18 months, that's got to be true, hasn't it? David, the words Global Britain weren't mentioned, but this was surely an interview about Global Britain.
Well, yes, that phrase perhaps gone a little bit off the favoured list, up to perhaps a little bit too much ridicule. And you think about what's been happening in the last few weeks, the sort of headlines this government's been facing, fuel shortages, energy crisis, shortages of food looming, Christmas about to be ruined, all of these things, that he didn't look like a prime minister sitting amidst all of that sort of chaos, did he? And he actually had a bit of a tan on. I think he's just back from a week in Marbella and looking relaxed. And as John just said, he does feel like he has control of the narrative, and he is able to talk in that very optimistic way, very positive way about all these things that are going to happen, without perhaps putting too much meat on the bones there or any actual detail. And that's a very kind of characteristic thing of Boris, isn't it? But as John said, it seems to be winning so far.
I think he faces a fundamental struggle. Is that in Brexit, there were always two sorts of people who supported Brexit. One was the people who believed that Brexit was a way of kind of holding back the forces of globalization, be it immigration, be it all these different things. And that is quite a big part of what the modern Tory party is. But the old Thatcherite Tory party would see Brexit as an excuse to create Singapore on the Thames. Mm. And what Boris has been doing is he has been speaking the language of the first Tories pretty much since the election. And to the extent this interview has any value or whatever's happening with the Global Investment Conference, he's now swinging back a bit. And he pointed out in the interview that back in 2008, when bankers were very unpopular, he was probably the person who was defending them most. And just economically, so much of the British economy relies on that more kind of open Global Britain idea.
And that's why I thought it was so fascinating, the answer around China. Within his own Conservative Party, there's been a seismic sort of change in terms of the attitude towards China. And he wouldn't sort of define what would or wouldn't be allowed in terms of investments into the UK.
Yeah, in the interview, I asked him whether he was the last Sinophile in the cabinet, and he dodged it. But I think there is an element of that. You look at, the Chinese have put various Tory MPs on sanctions lists. The Tories have pushed them out of, pushed Huawei quite a long way out of what it was doing in communications infrastructure. They have, they seem to be taking a dim view of the Chinese at Sizewell. Boris has, I think, this general view of the Chinese as a great empire. He always sort of keeps going back to that. And he began to do that before the conversation drifted in a different direction. But he, I think, is more enthusiastic, strangely, about the Chinese than many people in his party are.
Yeah, interesting. David, what did you make of the climate discussion and the Prime Minister talking about the 10-point Green Plan, which actually now is close to a year old? COP26, 120 global leaders expected, but possibly not Xi Jinping of China. And yet this is what the kind of Prime Minister's got to focus on, isn't it?
Yeah, well, they've put a lot of store in this conference, but there's been quite a lot of rolling of the pitch to prepare everyone for the fact that these talks really might not achieve very much at all. He said in the interview last night that it's going to be very tough to get an agreement. How can you get a significant agreement when the Chinese leader isn't going to be there? We don't know whether the Indian Prime Minister is going to be there. India and China are so key to getting any sort of meaningful agreement on net zero. So will COP turn out to be a flop? The government have made a huge amount of noise about this being Britain's moment in the sun to take a leadership stance in this. So perhaps with him dialing back some of those expectations, I think they're going to try and dodge the fact that maybe they're not going to get some huge earth-shattering commitment at these talks, but just another step in the process and the very torturous process of getting countries to agree. So is Britain in a leadership position there, or really just following the pack? I think it's hard to see how he comes out of these talks as a kind of triumphant leader if we don't get an agreement in 2 weeks' time.
John, what do you make of the issue around Northern Ireland? That seems to be perhaps calming down, that there was some optimism that there might be a resolution from what the Prime Minister said.
You hear from allies of Johnson and even some business people is that this should not be that difficult for the Europeans to fix if they it's not entirely a new concept in the European Union turning a blind eye to things, and that really is sort of what's being asked, or that's the available room of fudge, is just having a somewhat more flexible border between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland, and they might be able to do something on it. On the other hand, I think the Europeans, there's two things. One, they're cross with Johnson for having signed up to a particular thing. And then secondly, and this again goes right back to the French and Macron personally, that there is a general view that if the British left, they should suffer. It should not be if you can leave the European Union and it doesn't make much difference to you, well then there's not much point in being part of it. And that is, I think, quite a strong thing, that the British should suffer because of it. So there's a difficult bit between, on the one hand, the Europeans wanting to keep something which, as Johnson pointed out, is one of their main financial centres, is one of their main things. All the economic logic is to keep the British close. The political logic is not.
David, a word on the attitude to financial services and the City of London. And John made this point with the PM that some people see him as having ignored this enormous kind of cash cow. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And as John said, the focus at the end of the Brexit talks was on fishing, which is a tiny fraction of the economy compared to the City of London. There is no deal on services with the European Union. In fact, we're nowhere near getting some sort of equivalency agreement. In fact, most people in the city have given up on that. I don't think anyone thinks that's coming soon for the reasons that John just said. I think the French see an opportunity to wrest business. Mm. The question now is to what degree are they going to wrest that business? Are they going to insist things like much more the buy-side business that is so huge in London is going to have to be relocated? What about derivatives? What about clearing? There are lots of open questions as to how much the City of London is going to be made to suffer. And I think it's clear that the government doesn't really want to invest too much capital themselves in defending the City of London. And the levelling up agenda, those voters up in the north of England, they don't really care too much either. So I think you're seeing this government really put their eggs in different baskets than they are, where you would imagine a Conservative Party government to be.
John, this is a Prime Minister who wants to stay in office a decade, channelling Margaret Thatcher, if not Churchill himself. What are the risks in the next few months, do you think, to this PM?
The basic risk to this government is a very simple one, is that there is a slight imbalance between its, perceived competence and its poll ratings. So in other words, there are a variety of things not going that well with the British economy at the moment. And there is also I think most people would say, something of a talent shortage near the top of the party, because it has to be very defined by personal loyalty and Brexit loyalty. So that is that, and at some point, those two things tend to catch up with each other. Against that, I think, there is always doubts about Boris Johnson, about how long he really does want to stay on. Every now and again, he looks a bit tired and lethargic. Actually, for what it's worth, yesterday I thought he looked completely re-energized, as David pointed out, with a tan and back and happy in the life. But that's, a lot depends on him. It is a very, people voted for Boris Johnson, perhaps more than the Tories, and that's quite a rare position for a leader to be in. Thatcher and Blair are the two people who seem in that category.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.